So today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 25, called The Characteristics of King Puranjana. And we're going to do text number 23, which is on the board. But the purport is only one sentence, so we'll do text number 24 also. They both kind of speak about largely similar things. And then we'll try to say a few words about Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. Vishanganivim Sushronim Shyamam Kanakamekhalam Padbhyam Kvanadbhyam Chalantim Nupurair Devatameva. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The waist and hips of the woman were very beautiful. She was dressed in a yellow sari with a golden belt. While she walked, her ankle bells rang. She appeared exactly like a denizen of the heavens. Please repeat. The waist and hips of the woman were very beautiful. She was dressed in a yellow sari with a golden belt. While she walked, her ankle bells rang. She appeared exactly like a denizen of the heavens. Purport. This verse expresses the joyfulness of the mind upon seeing a woman with raised hips and breasts, dressed in an attractive sari and bedecked with ornaments. So next one also, and then we'll say a few words. Astano vyanjita kaishorau samavritto nirantarau vastrante nagnikuhantim vridaya gajagaminim. Translation. With the end of her sari, the woman was trying to cover her breasts, which were equally round and well placed side by side. She again and again tried to cover them out of shyness, while she walked exactly like a great elephant. Purport. The two breasts represent attachment and envy. The symptoms of raga and dvesha, attachment and envy, are described in Bhagavad Gita. Indriyasrendriyasyarthe raga dvesho vyavasthito tayor navasham agachet tohyasya paripanthano. Attraction and repulsion for sense objects are felt by embodied beings. But one should not fall under the control of the senses and sense objects, because they are stumbling blocks on the path of self-realization. These representatives of attachment and envy are very much unfavorable for advancement in spiritual life. One should not be attracted by the breasts of young women. The great saint Shankaracharya has described the breasts of women, especially young women, as nothing but a combination of muscles and blood. So one should not be attracted by the illusory energy of raised breasts with nipples. They are agents of Maya meant to victimize the opposite sex. Because the breasts are equally attractive, they are described as samavritto. The sex impulse remains in an old man's heart also, even up to the point of death. To be rid of such agitation, one must be very advanced in spiritual consciousness, like Yamuna Acharya, who said, Yadavadhi mama cheta krishna padara vinde navanavarasadhaman yutyatam rantumasit tadavadhi batanari sangame smaryamane bhavati mukhavikara sushtu nishtivanam cha. Since I have been engaged in the transcendental loving service of Krishna, realizing ever new pleasures in him, whenever I think of sex pleasure, I spit at the thought and my lips curl with distaste. When one is spiritually advanced, he can no longer be attracted by the lumps of flesh and blood, which are the breasts of young women. The word nirantaro is significant, because although the breasts are situated in different locations, the action is the same. We should not make any distinction between attachment and envy. As described in Bhagavad Gita, they are both products of rajoguna, kama esha krodha esha rajoguna samudbhava. The word niguhantim, trying to cover, indicates that even if one is tainted by kama, lobha, krodha, etc., they can be transfigured by Krishna consciousness. In other words, one can utilize kama, or lust, for serving Krishna. Being impelled by lust, an ordinary worker will work hard day and night. Similarly, a devotee can work hard day and night to satisfy Krishna. Just as karmis are working hard to satisfy kama krodha, a devotee should work in the same way to satisfy Krishna. Similarly, krodha or anger can also be used in the service of Krishna when it is applied to the non-devotee demons. Hanumanji applied his anger in this way. He was a great devotee of Lord Ramachandra and he utilized his anger to set fire to the kingdom of Ravana, a non-devotee demon. Thus, kama, lust, can be utilized to satisfy Krishna, and krodha, anger, can be utilized to punish the demons. When both are used for Krishna's service, they lose their material significance and become spiritually important.
Om Jnanati Mirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Sthapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kada Mahyam Dadati Swapadantikam.
So, there's a full verse here describing the breasts of women in Srimad Bhagavatam. I remember as a child, we used to read Srimad Bhagavatam translations when we were too young to read purports. We didn't have the attention span. And these were always sections that made us squirm. and my mother was very bold about it. She had decided that if it was in Bhagavatam, it was pure enough to be heard by anyone's ears, including children. And so we received most of our education in matters such as these through Bhagavatam. If you go to school, you get classes. I don't know if they do it here in Belgium, but in the United States, they often have classes in sex education. Quite at an early age, they start teaching you about men and women and how to be responsible and as you grow older, they give you more details and so forth, with the idea that you're supposed to be responsible about such things. So we don't have to look outside of Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that all the knowledge of the world is present, Prabhupada says also, that all the knowledge of the world is present in Srimad Bhagavatam, including detailed knowledge about the breasts of women. And so we read through it and we squirmed a little bit, but eventually we understood as we grew older. That in fact, the point is that this whole world, it comes in pairs, right? Everyone, everything in this world comes in pairs. You see the birds, they fly in pairs. You see the lions and tigers, they come in pairs. You see just everything. Everything comes in pairs in this world, twos. Opposites, male and female, hot and cold, day and night. This is a world of duality, right? It's dvandva, this world is called. It's a place of duality where opposites always come together, and opposites somehow are very closely attached also to each other. Whereas the spiritual world is a place of advandva, which is non-duality. Right? And so Prabhupada is saying this desire is so intense within the heart, right, that practically he says anyone, sometimes we associate this just with those who are youthful and passionate, but even an old man, Prabhupada is saying, doesn't give up those desires in the heart. It's not like by age one automatically becomes free of these desires. And not by age, but by practice, by intelligence, one becomes free. But even an old man, he says, there's one story he tells of Akbar and Birbal, you know, the Muslim king and his Hindu minister, famous stories in India. Birbal, the minister, was very witty, and Akbar used to enjoy sparring with him verbally and trying different tricks and so forth. And so one day they got into a discussion about sex desire, and Akbar, I think it was, he was joking with Birbal and saying, now you're getting an old man, you don't have these desires anymore, how could you have them? And Birbal was saying, actually these desires, they stay till the very end. Even a very, very old person will have these desires. And Akbar said, I don't believe you, this just can't be true. So Birbal said, it's okay, I'll show you, come. There was a very old member of court, right, old minister who was actually on his deathbed, he said, it's nice if the king visits him before he dies,
But when you come, bring the princess along as well. And of course, the princess was very young and very beautiful. All princesses are beautiful, it seems. I've never heard of ugly princesses. They must exist, no? They must exist. Not every princess can be beautiful. But at least in stories, there are only beautiful princesses. So he brings his princess, and the king enters first. Right? And of course, it's the king. I mean, it's the emperor of India. And everyone is at attention when the king arrives. And this old man also, the king is here, right? Even though he's dying. But as soon as the princess enters, the old man doesn't see the king anymore. Right? He can't see anything except for the princess. He's straining every muscle he's got left in his body to just have one last look at this princess. Right? And the king can see this. Right? And he looks at Birbal and nods, and Birbal nods and says, "See? I told you." Right? So that desire is there in the core of the heart. It's there in every living entity at any stage of development. Sometimes it's more manifest and other times it's less. Sometimes it comes in subtle ways, sometimes in not so subtle ways. But that basic desire is there embedded in us. It can manifest as direct attraction for the opposite sex. It can manifest as a desire to eat very sumptuous, rich, and extraordinary food. Right? But the same passion, the rajoguna, the lust in the heart, Prabhupada is saying it propels us to work hard day and night. It propels us to look for sense enjoyment. And of course, it propels us to find a member of the opposite sex, which is kind of the heart of the whole thing. Sometimes people can say, well, aren't you guys a bit fixated on this whole problem of man and woman? You seem to like to talk about it a lot. When I'm reading your books, you're always talking about it. Maybe the reason you're so worked up about this is because you think about it so much. And if you just kind of let it be and relax and let life go on, then maybe it wouldn't be such a big deal anymore. Right? And yes, okay, there's truth to that. If we meditate on something too much, even in a negative fashion, it's actually just a form of attraction. Right? Prabhupada is saying raga and dvesha. Attachment and hatred is actually exactly the same thing, just different sides of the same coin. If you're very attached to something, you cannot stop thinking about it. If you hate something, you cannot stop thinking about it. Right? So yes, that's true. But in fact, the sages, the author of Srimad Bhagavatam, our great acharyas, they know human nature very, very well. Right? They understand the way human psychology works. Sometimes we might get this feeling like, oh, you know, they're overemphasizing one point, or they're really, you know, whatever. But they actually understand human psychology very well, because these sages, they observe everything. If you read the descriptions of Bhagavatam in terms of relationships between human beings, they're right on the mark. Right? They're very astute in their observation of the world. This is what sages do. Right? They're called rishis, which means seers. They observe the world. This is their work. And by their observation, they then gain spiritual knowledge. They try to free themselves from that attachment, and they instruct others as well. And their point is that, in fact, we can pretend like this is not the main point in the material world. Right? That, oh, actually, it's not, you know, that's important. We can just, but that we're just fooling ourselves. Right? Everywhere we look, everywhere you turn, this is the main point. You look at advertising, this is the main point. You look at television programs, you look at books that are written, this is the main point. Professors know that if there's a class where you discuss anything about men and women's relationships, the students will be 100% attentive, and you'll get a very, very good participation in that class. Right? Everyone knows this. At every sphere of life, in every place, in every activity of human existence, this is the only juice, only rasa we find in this material world. Right? It's the only glimmer of happiness we find in this material world. Prabhupada even says that sports, right? Sports, as he says, between men and women is just a subtle form of sex life. He said, one sex likes to observe the physical body of the opposite sex. Right? So the sages, they see this in every aspect of human existence because it's there, not because they're fixated about it or because they're making it up, but because it's actually present. In the human psychology, in the human being. Why? Why is it so strong? Why is it so powerful? Why is it so nearly impossible to give up? Because in fact, this desire, this kama, is the reflection, it's the opposite side of the deepest desire of the soul, right? Which is to love Krishna. This relationship with Krishna, Jivera Sharupoi Krishnera Nitya Das, this relationship we have with Krishna is reflected in the material world in terms of our relationship between man and woman. That desire, that happiness, that sex desire is actually a reflection of true rasa, which is found in the spiritual world. And that is the deepest character of the soul. It is what we're made of, right? We're Satchidananda. That's what we're made of. So how can we get rid of it ever? It's impossible to get rid of, practically. The only thing that can happen is that we can sublimate it, right? We can make it sublime. We can transfer it from something that is base and selfish into something that is advanced and selfless in nature. And that's what's called bhakti, right? That's called devotion. So how do we do that? What's the way to do that? Krishna discusses this cycle in Bhagavad Gita, famous verses. He says, Dhyayato vishayan pungsa sangasteshu pajayate sangat sanjayate kama kama krodad bijayate krodad bhavati sammoha sammoha smiti vibhrama smiti brahmashat buddhinathashu shatpranashyati. He says, while contemplating the objects of the senses, we develop attachment for them. From attachment, lust develops. From lust, anger. From anger, bewilderment of memory. From when memory is bewildered, intelligence is lost, buddhinasho. And when intelligence is lost, we fall down again into the material pool. Pranashyati, everything's destroyed, he says. This is a cycle we could illustrate, we could describe, but anyway, you can understand that this works. It's very real. We can see this happening. You think of something, some thought enters the mind, some desire, some feeling, some... And we start turning it over in our head. We start, we turn it over, look at it from different sides and examine it. And start to enjoy the thought of it, right? Just think of something rather innocent, like eating some dish that you really like. What it might be, sandesh or maha sweets or pizza or whatever. Right? Someone plants the thought in your mind at a time when you're hungry or whatever. Then it's such a pleasing thought. We turn it over, we taste the pizza in our mind, and we add various spicings to it, and so forth, and we're relishing it already. Dhyayato vishayan pungsa sangasteshu pajayate. When we think about it, then sangha. Then immediately we're associating with it, at least in the mind. That attachment becomes there. And from that sangha, sangat sanjayate kama, from that association we create kama, all kinds of desires arise within the heart. Then we have to have it. Right? We head over to the restaurant, we got to go find something to eat. Right? Sanjat sanjayate kama. And then, of course, restaurant is closed, it's a Monday, so then krodha, right? It's anger. Why is the restaurant closed? It's only 6 o'clock and they're already closed and they should be open till 8 and this and that. Right? So krodhad bhavati. Then we become bewildered, right? Krodhad bhavati sammoha, sammoha smriti vibhrama, and so forth. And pretty soon our intelligence is lost and we're criticizing devotees and the managers of the restaurant. And why do they do this and why can't they run it? All kinds of terrible things happen and pretty soon we fall down again. So this cycle, of course, can be repeated in so many ways, for some innocent things, for not so innocent things. I once asked, when I was, a teenager or so, I asked Ganapati Swami. He's a sannyasi who comes to Boise regularly. He's American, travels all throughout the United States, mostly Western United States. Very simple. He travels in his camper and he distributes books at universities across the country. And he used to come to Boise a lot when we were just starting off there. It was kind of way out of the way. And he used to drive there, distribute books. And I asked him, Maharaj, how can you stop this cycle? Suppose you get caught in it. And suppose you find yourself on that slippery slope. How can you stop yourself? How can you pull yourself out? And Maharaj said, you can't. Right. Once that cycle begins and you develop that attachment, that sangha, that association, the desires will come. And once you have those desires, then those desires will be frustrated ultimately. And so anger will come and so forth. You cannot stop the process. He says the only point at which you can stop it, the only point where you still have a little bit of control, is at the very first step. Dhyayato vishayan pungsa. When the thought, when the desire first enters the mind, then chik, at that point, you have a moment, a window of opportunity, where you can cut it off. You can say no. You can engage the intelligence, because the intelligence is still not destroyed, right? Intelligence is destroyed a little bit farther down the road. So you still have the ability to use the intelligence and put an end to it and say, stop, hold on, why am I doing this? Right? How can I do this? I'm not going to let myself go there, right? We say in English, don't go there. Right? Don't let yourself go there. Just, you can cut it off. At that time, Krishna gives you the strength to do it. But if you give in and you let that thought turn over in your head over and over again, the attachment will develop, the attachment will lead to lust and so forth. And so, we can do this in any situation, right? For example, in the attraction to the opposite sex, this is natural, Prabhupada says, in everyone's mind, whether they're young or they're old, right? That thought, that attraction, that distraction will come. It's difficult to avoid. It'll come, but we don't have to do something about it. Right? We don't have to dwell upon it. We can put an end to it when it shows up. I remember when I was a teenager and starting to go to university for the first time and, dealing with, okay, I'm a brahmachari, I'm in an environment where there's so much association with all kinds of people and especially with the opposite sex. How do I deal with a situation like this? What do I do? Right? The mind, it'll go so many places. And I would try, after Maharaj said this, it's something, you know, sometimes someone says something to you and it sticks with you, it just kind of lodges itself. It's Krishna's mercy, really. Sometimes he gives instruction through devotees and it lodges in your brain and it just kind of gets stuck there and it doesn't come out. And Maharaj's instruction was like that. It was kind of came at the right point in my life and it just kind of got stuck there. And I thought, okay, this is, you know, it's the thinking. That's the only opportunity I have. And so whenever some thoughts would arise or some attraction would subconsciously arise in the mind, you start, you know, some desire to flirt is there or whatever, then immediately, okay, engage the intelligence. I would think to myself, where is this going to go? Like, what are you going to do with this? Right? Suppose you become attached. Right? Can you think of marrying this girl? Obviously not, right? Well, why not? Well, number one, she's not a devotee. I'd like to marry a devotee. Number two, I'm only 18. It's a little early, maybe. Number three, you know, and so forth. And you just engage the intelligence and give yourself some very practical reasons why this is not going to work, right? In other words, you ask yourself, would I be willing to get married to her tomorrow? And if the answer is no, right, then why put yourself through all that suffering? Right? Why engage in this self-torture of becoming attracted and then becoming attached and then trying to find any way to run into her and then trying to figure out what to say to her when you see her next and then at the end it's not going to work out anyway and then you'll be heartbroken. Right? And I saw my classmates go through this cycle over and over and over and over and over again. Right? It's a process of self-torture that everyone puts themselves through. But why? Right? If you can actually see yourself, if this can go somewhere, right? Then okay, maybe it's worth it, right? Maybe it's worth it. But if it's not going to go anywhere, what's the point? Right? Why do it? And one of the basic facts, if you do this kind of thing, you realize that 99% of our desires in this world cannot actually go anywhere. Right? Whether it's a desire for a girl or for a boy, whether it's a desire to go on a particular vacation, whether it's a desire to have some kind of a material object like an iPhone or a computer or whatever, right? 99.9% of the time our desires cannot go anywhere. All we do is we turn them over in our head and then we create misery for ourselves. In the case of the opposite sex, it's worse because you create misery not just for yourself, but for the other person too. A boy or a girl will so easily pick up cues from another boy or girl. So easily. You think that, oh, I'm not doing anything. Right? I didn't even talk to her yet. But that doesn't make a difference. If the desire is there in the mind and you're turning over it, then the other person will pick it up. Right? It will manifest. There's no doubt about it. Because we're tuned to do this. This is hardwired into us. So you're creating that attachment in yourself, which will lead to suffering. And then you're creating it someone else at the same time. And that will also send them for a spin, whether it's a girl charming a boy or a boy charming a girl. And then in that way, you break your heart and you break the other person's heart. When you know from the start, your intelligence should be able to tell you, this is not going to go anywhere. At an early age, you can tell yourself, look, I'm too young. When you get a little bit older, you can tell yourself, look, I'm going to marry a devotee. When you get a little bit older, you can say, well, I want to do this properly, right? If I'm going to get married, then I want to take people's advice about it. I want to get together a group or a committee of devotees, of grihasthas, who can help me in this process, right? Rather than just stumbling into it and then a few years later stumbling out of it. Right? No, I want to do this. So we can explain to ourselves, okay, when is the right time? And if we use the intelligence like this, then Krishna will always, always tell us when the right time is there. When whatever desire we have in our heart, when we can actually receive that, when we can satisfy it. Or he'll get rid of the desire, one of the two. But Krishna will always guide us, he'll always help us in that direction. I remember when, after I was a brahmachari for a number of years, and I decided that I was going to become a grihastha, right, that I wanted to get married. And kind of, you know, had consulted with people, thought about this, thought about it a lot. And said, okay, now, I'm going to make this decision, right? I'm 24, 25 years old, now it's time to decide, and I want to decide. Okay, I'm going to do this. As soon as, of course, I had decided this, then the mind was saying, well, now you're not a brahmachari anymore, right? So let's start looking. Yeah, you can figure out who's there and what's to do, and maybe she's the one, and maybe she's the right one, and she looks perfect. You know, and then that just sends the mind into a totally different spin. As a brahmachari, you've got a different spin, and this as a prospective grihastha, it's even worse. You know, now all kinds of possibilities are there. And so I thought, no, this can't be good, right? This can't be, again, this can't be the idea, because you're doing the same thing. Dhyayato vishayan pungsa sangasteshu. So it may lead, I don't want to end up in the wrong place at the wrong time. So I thought, okay, and the mind was getting a little disturbed. I still remember where I was, what I was doing. It's very kind of, it was one of those moments in spiritual life. And I pulled, there happened to be a full set of Bhagavatam in that room I was staying. And I thought, okay, let me see. Krishna, I need some guidance. You know, this mind is really driving me nuts. So I pulled just a volume out of the shelf randomly, opened it up, and the purport that was right there, Prabhupada was saying that if a devotee desires to get married, if a boy decides to get married, he should have firm faith that Krishna will provide him a girl who is just suitable to him. She will in fact be a princess, and he will give her the princess when the time is right. Similarly, a girl should be confident that Krishna will give her a boy just suitable to her heart's desire. And therefore, they should simply go on serving Krishna, as always, and leave it to the Lord. Once he knows your desire, he'll take care of it. It was just, it was like, I nearly fell over. It was like a... whew, it was so intense. And it was, of course, the section of Kardamamuni and Devahuti, where Kardamamuni was doing his austerities for the Lord. He was doing his devotional service. He had a desire in his heart. He expressed that desire to the Lord, but he never did anything about it, so to speak. He's just serving the Lord as he always was, but praying to him. And when the Lord came, he expressed his desire honestly. He says, look, I want to get married. And then, just at that time, along comes Swayambhuva Manu with his beautiful daughter Devahuti and says, hey, I'm looking for a match. Would you mind marrying her? Right? And at that point, Prabhupada says, see, Krishna will always provide, he'll provide the boy a princess to get married to, and the girl would get a boy suitable to her heart's desire. But they should simply go on serving Krishna. And after the mind, the mind became peaceful. Okay,
Krishna will help. Right? Krishna will do it. At no point in our life do we have to engage in dhyayato vishayan pungsa sangasteshu. We never have to contemplate the objects of the senses. This takes faith, of course, because sometimes we think we have to, otherwise things won't move forward. But we really don't. We really don't. All we have to do is place our desire in front of Krishna, if we have one, and that's it. We don't have to contemplate the desire itself, because it will always lead to some kind of attachment and problems, basically, from that point. So, kind of the last thing, I guess, is, again, someone might say, well, you know, your process of Krishna consciousness sounds very repressive to me. You guys go through life just kind of putting a lid on yourself, not expressing your desires and struggling to keep the lid on. Right? And you become like pressure cookers, where one day you just, the pressure is going to come to a point where you're just going to explode. And then, you know, you're going to bloop or you're going to leave or something like that. Right? And we hear that often. And it comes from a particular conception of psychology of the human mind, which describes the human mind as some kind of a pressure cooker, right? Where steam builds up, steam builds up, steam builds up, and you occasionally have to let the steam out, take the lid off, and it comes out, and then okay, you can let it build up for some time. This is a Freudian concept of psychology, right? The idea that we've got this id inside, this lower self, which is just bubbling with emotion, and society puts a lid on it, which eventually is going to explode if you don't have some kind of outlet. Right. And we may not know very much about Freud, but his ideas have so much permeated Western society, society all over the world, actually. So it comes from this particular concept of the mind as some kind of a pressure cooker. But we don't have to accept that concept of mind. In fact, the Vedas don't. Right? The mind, they say, they don't describe it as a pressure cooker. Instead, we can think of the mind as a child, right? as a little child. Who is restless, but can be trained. Right? No one says, oh, the child is like a pressure cooker, right? If I make him brush his teeth every day, one day he'll explode and do something. I don't know, right? You don't think like that. You say, no, he has to brush his teeth every day. This will give him training, and when he'll grow up, he'll brush his teeth every day. Right? There's no buildup of, ugh, I can't brush my teeth. No, it's something called discipline. You train the child and it disciplines, and then it becomes natural. It's not painful as we grow up to brush our teeth every day. Right? It becomes something that's very natural. In the same way, the mind is like that. It's like a child. If we train it, and the longer we train it, the more consistently, then it will become natural. Right? It'll become natural not to focus on the objects of the senses. It'll be natural to avert the eyes, to avoid such things. Right? Because the mind is trained in that way. The desire even may be there, but no, the training is okay there. So we've trained our mind after years of practice of Krishna consciousness, and in that way we can stay focused. What finer example of that can there be than His Divine Grace Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur? Right? He was the epitome of that kind of self-control, right? That kind of ability to stop the mind through the power of the intelligence. He was an extremely learned scholar, and because of that, he was offered a very prestigious chair at the University of Calcutta as a professor of astronomy. But he rejected it. He rejected it. Why? Because he said, well, as soon as I get a job, you know what that means. You have to get married. And first, my family wants me to take a job, or these people, rather, want me to take a job, then next I will have to get married. It's kind of a fact. This is the way you get involved in the world, and then you need protection as a result. Right? Otherwise, it's a very dangerous place. If you stay involved in this world and you don't have protection by a relationship with a husband or wife, then practically anything can happen. Right? So you need that kind of protection. You have that kind of desire. That need is there in the heart. So you have to do it. So he said, no, I'm not going to do it. Right? I'm not going to go there. Forget it. That desire may be there, but I'm not going to allow. I'm not going to go there at all. I'm not going to indulge in that desire. He was like this even as a child. You remember the story of the mango, right? Where his father brought home fresh mangoes from the market. And as just a little child, naturally, he grabbed. He wanted to eat them. They look so good. But his father said, no, they're not offered yet. How can you eat something that's not offered? And he felt so bad
that he had contemplated the objects of the senses, right, in a selfish way, without thinking of Krishna, that he said, I'm never going to eat mangoes again. And Prabhupada says, yes, our Guru Maharaj, anytime we'd offer, someone would offer him mangoes, he would say, no, I cannot take, I'm a sinner. Right? Imagine the strength it takes, the amount of intelligence it takes to live in India and give up pretty much the only source of happiness in the summer months is mangoes. It's phenomenal, right? It's amazing. His whole life is an example of that kind of self-control. But that self-control that he had was not a product of hatred or dislike of anyone else. It's not that he hated grihasthas. It's not like he hated women. No. His greatest mentor in life was his own father, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Right? So many wonderful things he has to say about him. And he was a grihastha, an excellent, ideal grihastha, right? With 10 children and so many things. His dearmost disciple, his foremost disciple, was his divine grace Srila Prabhupada, who was also a grihastha while Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was on this planet. And yet he invested all his faith in this disciple, even though others sometimes felt, oh, he's just a grihastha, what can he do? But he said, no, in due course of time, he will do everything. So the point is, it's not that, okay, raga and then dvesha, okay, we're not attached, so I'm going to hate everything in this world then. No, that does become unnatural, right? That does become repressive, that I'm going to go around hating everything. No, that's not the idea. No, we're neither attached, we're neither hate. We just see things for what they are. Right? This is the material body, this is the nature of attraction in this world. I also have these desires in my heart, but by training, by proper use of the intelligence, I can get over them. By following the advice of the scriptures, by following the example of great acharyas, we can do it, right? This is why Krishna sends the devotees. It's not because, oh, they're on some platform and there's no way I could be anyway like them. No, they're there so we can follow their example. We can take inspiration from them. If I'm a brahmachari, I can be like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So fixed, why not? And if I'm a grihastha, I can be like Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Why not? Right? We, of course, cannot be exactly like them, but we can follow in their footsteps. And that's kind of the purpose of days such as these, when we observe appearance and disappearance days, is we meditate on those qualities and we try to imbibe them in our own lives. We try to follow their examples and find some way to apply them. Okay, thank you very much for your attention. I guess if there's maybe one question or a comment, I can take that and then we end. Yes, bro.
Since all you lose intelligence, you become angry. Right?
Yes. Anger is part of the process of losing that intelligence.
So why can't you engage with intelligence and realize that you're becoming angry?
You can. It's not like there's no hope afterwards. But it becomes increasingly difficult. It's like quicksand. Right? You're in it. If you notice it early and you calm down and you pull yourself out, you're okay. But you keep struggling. The longer you struggle, then the more difficult it gets to pull out. The more you need intervention, right? And the point is, even at a later stage, we can be helped. It's a fact. And we have examples, even perhaps from our own life, we may know some examples where we were in a very, very bad situation, we were helped. But usually that requires some serious intervention. And this is why the association of devotees is so useful. Because sometimes a devotee will come into a situation and say, look, this is nuts, you got to pull out. Right? And sometimes when that happens, you come to that point of attachment and involvement, then sometimes the only way to deal with it is to pull oneself out of the situation. And then you kind of, when you're out of it, you, whew. This happens in India a lot. Sometimes children go off to study and they fall in love with someone there at the university or whatever, and it's, you know, not a very good match, and the parents have dreams of an arranged marriage for their kids and so forth. So the mother will show up there and she'll take the kid by the collar and drag him away. I mean, they will literally, if it means moving to a different university, they'll do that. I knew a mother who did that, came all the way to the United States and did that, and dragged her kid back to India and said no. So devotees can often function in this way, right? When we find ourselves in a sinking situation, then we need intervention usually. That was Maharaj's point, that if you want to do something about it, your best bet is right at the beginning.
Right? After that, yes, it's not like there's never hope. I mean, this is why we're here, is because there's always hope. But then it requires more and more support and more drastic measures. And you may not even be able to see at that point that you need help. You may be so overcome with anger. And it might take someone else who has the great compassion, mercy, and courage to enter that situation and put their own neck on the line to help you out and pull you out, knowing well that they might get a reaction for that. Right? So it takes more things to fall into place for us to be helped. But earlier on, it's very easy, and we can do much better. Okay. Right.
Of course, it also works for us.
Right.
That is one of the reasons why it's stronger than us.
Right. Yeah. We have to admit that. That's a very important point. Right at the start, we have to admit. If we try to face our desires in the material world with the mood of arrogance, then definitely we're setting ourselves up for failure. Wow, I'm so, you know, I can't be affected. I've not been attracted for years now, and then it happens. You know, at the age of 55, it'll happen. If we develop that pride in our heart, that, oh, I'm, you know, immune to it now. Mm-hmm. Prabhupada says we're not afraid of Maya enough. Right, we don't. Every day, he said, I'm praying to Krishna, please protect me from Maya. So, we have to approach it with a sense of humility. That no, I'm weak. The sense objects are stronger. Everything is stronger in this world. I'm practically the weakest element here, right? But by Krishna's mercy, right, I can survive. It'll work. Thank you all very much for your attention. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur Goswami Prabhupada Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.